know, at least I have tried to make that perhaps overly clear. I'm extremely new to this, and therefore it's bound to make many mistakes and probably oversee many issues that for you are clear, but for me it's slightly cloudy. So I rely upon being guided, and I listen carefully, and I will not be offended even if you are overly clear. This subgroup is looking at the distinction between whether there should be made distinctions, and in the brief they suggested a couple of possible ways of making such distinctions prior to this meeting, but very only yesterday.
Okay,
I released a small.
Hello.
I released a small paper discussing some of this, and some of you may have been able to glance through that paper, but I thought perhaps it might be appropriate at the start to look into or summarize some of the points made in that paper. Perhaps we first of all should make sure that our brief is to discuss whether a distinction should be made between registration contracts information based on the nature of the registrant name or the use of the domain name. It obviously is part of a much larger issue, and it may be difficult to find where to draw the line in our discussions, especially as the question whether a distinction should be made obviously relies on why a distinction should be made, which policies are served, and which interests are served by making a certain distinction. And the discussion therefore easily might spill over into the why, rather keeping it to the whether, as they are so intimately related. Any comments at this time?
John Philip here, just one. I think the wording from the work plan from the charter is determine whether and how a distinction could be made. So I think we're probably just looking at the ability to make a distinction, and then if the answer presumably is no further work, if the answer is yes, then we need to decide what practical use we can make of the distinction. So that's how I view our task.
You may indeed be right, though I copied the should from the document passed by the council. But the charter may have been amended compared to that decision. So you may very well be right.
Okay.
At least we are looking into the operational part of it, not into the more political issue. So we're looking whether a distinction should be made. Any other comments? Otherwise, I'll try to walk you through this brief paper. It is indeed brief. It has only six points to it. The first point is the nature of personal data. Personal data, the term data is used rather than information, with also being
a...
Hello. As I said, the word data is used rather than information, without there being too much of an intention behind that variation in terminology. And I have cited the definition which has the strongest or widest acceptance, which is found in the European Data Protection Directive, which says that personal data shall mean any information relating to an identified or identifiable natural person. And such a person is known as a data subject. And then it goes on trying to explain what is an identifiable person. That is one who can be identified directly or indirectly in particular by reference to an identification number or to one or more factors specific to his physical, physiological, mental, economic, cultural, or social identity. And this is a definition that opens for a lot of discussion, a discussion which I myself have contributed to, and which I'll refrain from doing, because the main point here is the limitation of persons to natural persons. And I make the small point that dead persons, deceased, are usually not seen as a natural person. So death is rather natural. And that the identifying element usually is name or an identification number or then other factors. But that do not, I think, concern us overly, as it will be the name which will be the major identifiable element in our context. And one problem is, of course, that a false name is an identifiable, or is a personal data. Then, having done with natural persons, I look at legal persons, or the note, and try to describe legal persons, which will be specific to the jurisdiction concerned. And the reason for creating legal persons are mainly found in the desire to separate the liability of a business from the liability of the person taking part in that business. There are certainly a great deal of variety and inventiveness used in creating different forms of legal persons within the different jurisdictions, but again, it doesn't seem to be too difficult to make the distinction in principle. And then in the third section, I look at the principle in practice and point out that for small and medium-sized businesses, there often is an identification between the business and the legal person and the persons who operate the business. That is the fourth point. That creates an uncertainty and may make it difficult in practice to maintain distinction in principle, but it is done in most jurisdictions. As I said, I jumped across one point, and that is a point which has been made with some force by several, that a legal person cannot have data protection rights. Data protection may be the reason one wants to make a distinction between natural persons and legal persons. Some maintain that to say a legal person having privacy rights is a contradiction in terms, as privacy is something related to the basic human rights. But if you look at the more mundane version of privacy, which often is described as data protection, you'll find that, for instance, the U.S. Fair Credit Reporting Act equals both individuals and legal persons. Then I briefly try to look at the distinction between commercial and non-commercial purpose. And some of you may be willing to complement or supplement this discussion, but it seems to me that it is an extremely difficult a distinction to make, and in my experience it's drawn differently within different areas of law, even within one jurisdiction, and it has no clear meaning. It may be that it's acting in competition, in a competitive market. It may be that it is acting with the objective of making a profit, and there may be other ideas behind the phrase commercial purposes. It certainly is used in several contexts, for instance, in the fair use discussions doctrine in the United States, certainly in other jurisdictions, but it seems to be extremely difficult to use this as a distinction on which to base an operative and international provision, but I may be wrong. And then I finally mentioned the possible distinction between public and private organizations, if one should want to look at that, and one probably won't, because that also is a difficult distinction, especially in a situation where public agencies, to a large extent, outsource functions, and blurring the distinction between the private and the public sector, which has been a development going on for some decades, though, and therefore making that less attractive. And it hasn't. It is my own. Well, I just put it in there because it seemed to be something that should be discussed. But there is no indication in the documents that this is an alternative that should be further explored. But in summing up, I find that it is a distinction between natural persons on one hand and legal persons on the other hand that seems to be most operative, and which also seems to have can be based, argued on the that there is a reason for making that distinction, this reason then being data protection. That is perhaps not so brief, but that is my summing up, and I let you speak as you like. Please.
John Philip here. I think that summary up was excellent and very clear. Thank you for that. And I think your tentative conclusion that distinction between legal and natural is the more achievable one to make is also one that I've heard elsewhere, and it may be an interesting question to know if anybody on the call has a different opinion to that. I said the second question we come to later is what we do with distinction, but first we're just looking at the practicality of making a distinction.
Let me perhaps add only the Philip to this. Several have made that conclusion, but the Norwegian Ministry of Justice did not make that conclusion when drafting the first Data Protection Act. They say it was so difficult to make this distinction that they refrained from doing it and extended data protection to legal persons. That has later been amended, but it certainly makes it, in my mind, clear that both arguments can be defended.
Okay. Okay.
John, this is Bertrand here.
Hello, Bertrand.
Just a few comments. Thanks for the summary that actually highlights the benefits of the distinction between the legal entities and the individuals. One element of answer to the question whether distinctions could be made, apart from the technical aspect, I just want to give the example that I checked in France. The registration in the national CCTLD.fr makes a distinction between the legal entities and the individuals. And it makes this distinction not only in the way the data is accessed, but also in the type of data that is collected. Like, for instance, if you register a domain name in .fr as an entity, commercial or non, you have to indicate your number of registrations, whereas if you are a private person, you will enter your private address. So the distinction can be made, is actually made in certain cases. The key question is there a distinction only in the way data is accessed, or is there a distinction as well in the nature of the data that is collected? And the other point I wanted to raise is that I remember in discussions with the Canadian GAC representative that apparently, from what I understood, they were making a distinction that was more based on the commercial, non-commercial activity. But this is just hearsay, and I'm not sure that I understood well. So anybody who can provide another clarification is welcome.
You're coming and going in my ear, Bertrand, because I got the last thing about the Canadian example of commercial and non-commercial. And if you, of course, are within jurisdiction, and there is a form for illegal persons which are, for instance, for a non-commercial purpose, that would be an operative criterion and could be used. But I find it difficult to use it across jurisdictions.
It's Neil Schwartzman here. Sitting in Canada, I can say that there is a distinction made between the use of data by individuals and commercial entities, and certainly that seems to be the operative point by which we can launch investigations by way of the Office of the Privacy Commissioner. But I did want to make another point, which is as I think I was quite clear on the main discussion list some time ago, representing the Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email, my primary concern is for the ability of spam investigators and security investigators to be able to use who is as continually as a resource to which we can track network abuse back to specific miscreants. And this discussion raises the question, what would stop somebody with malintent from simply declaring themselves as an individual as opposed to a commercial entity so that they could further limit access to their data?
This is Aubrey. Can I comment on that?
Yes, please.
I mean, one of the things is that would fall into the accuracy and verification of information. If someone was making such a claim, and such a claim, the claim of being a private person, and such a claim was not sustainable, just like an inaccurate address, there would have to be a process as part of the accuracy process for determining that this was not true. And that would be the way of determining whether your alleged miscreant was indeed not a private, a natural person entitled to the protection of privacy / data protection. So that's part of the accuracy requirement.
Yes.
And to date, we have seen little or no application of the accuracy requirement, unfortunately.
I think that's inaccurate, Neil, actually. I believe if you read the reports, you'll see a history of application of the accuracy policies. But I'm not sure what the relevance this has to the work of this particular subgroup.
Well, again, if somebody decided that they wanted to register themselves as an individual, we need to find a mechanism to verify that at the point of registration, not after they've done damage.
Okay, yes. Philip, just a comment. I mean, we are making a leap forward that's moving potentially out of scope in terms of where this subgroup is. I think first question is, can a distinction be made? And then if yes, what do you do with that distinction, and how is that distinction made? Okay, now I think your question was presupposing that there would be a self-declaration, and then your second part of that was another supposition: what do you do in the case of a false self-declaration?
Yeah.
So that's already a set of levels away, perhaps from where we are. So I think we need to structure our dialogue, because I think once you get into either verification or challenge of data, to my mind, we're probably coming back more to the work of our subgroup 4A, which is what is the designated contact all about, and what is their responsibilities, and my supposition is that one of those responsibilities is going to be to do with verification of data. So we it's probably helpful if we see pointers to go back into the same sort of process if we make those as we go along, rather than try to answer them ourselves.
Philip, fair enough. I just wanted to raise a red flag early on, or a yellow flag, a yellow card, as it were, so that we are aware of potential pitfalls as we move forward.
Sure.
I think that also is an important note, because even if we make the distinction between legal persons and individuals, you next have the question, what if the data in the individual is inaccurate, for instance, false, and that has both causes for or consequences for whether the data then remains private or for the verification process, and it obviously is part of a more general issue. But it is difficult, as I initially said, to separate them, because you have to talk about the cause in looking towards the effects to some certain extent.
This is Chris Gibson. I agree, and I think it's important. It will be important as we lay out possible alternatives to also, perhaps when they're reported, to report them with the red flags that might attach. As a question or as a proposal for how to proceed in this group, I would suggest that we have two. We set up two sort of wish lists, one for focusing on the first distinction, and that's the one we've talked about here today, legal versus natural persons, and focusing on whether and how a distinction can be made on that basis, and then a second wish list, which is one that would focus on the distinction based on use of the domain name, for example, commercial versus non-commercial, and then again ask members of the group to provide perhaps proposals for a distinction on that basis, along perhaps with the red flags that come with those possible distinctions. But I see it as there's two different distinctions that are requested to be focused on, and we can make a sort of a list of alternatives for following under each, which also would then obviously be accompanied, for example, by the red flags that we just talked about. But they're essentially two levels, and they implicate different things. You can imagine a process in which you capture information at the outset of a registration, whether the entity is a legal versus natural person, or also you can ask the question about intended use at the outset of the registration. Is this a commercial versus a non-commercial use? And both of those would be self-declarations. But again, I think we should have those two tracks and ask for members to perhaps put in proposals based in response to each of those two. And then from that, we can have a further discussion. I found the background paper by John to be very helpful, because it does show in the gray areas how difficult these things can be.
This is Ross here, folks.
Yes.
Before we proceed with that suggestion or considering that suggestion, I'd first like to continue with continue running down the path of discussing whether or not distinctions can be made along these lines. I think the policy basis for making a distinction between legal and natural registered name holders is relatively straightforward, so to speak. I think certainly given all the caveats that John has laid out are extremely salient and pertinent. But I'm not sure that the policy basis for making such a distinction along commercial and non-commercial use of a domain name is as straightforward. So I'd like to understand that set of questions better before we go down the road of creating wish lists that would help us impose those restrictions.
On the second one, let me make a quick comment. This is Chris. I do have great concerns on a distinction on the second one, particularly given the dynamic nature of websites and what can be commercial one day is non-commercial. I mean, what can be non-commercial one day is commercial the next. My experience as a panelist in dispute in both UDRP and nominant disputes is that often you find that things change very quickly, and so, you know, that is a real concern as to the second distinction, you know, something that can change so quickly and dynamically as the content of a website.
Yeah, Philip, my own instinct is I tend to agree, because whereas the distinction between a legal and a natural person is essentially a given distinction. You know, the entity is either one or the other. The commercial versus non-commercial related to use does strike me to be a potentially moving target.
Multidimensional.
And exactly, yes. So I think, as always in business, one's instinct is to go for the definable and the simple.
Yeah.
So that would be certainly my comment.
Hi, just Bertrand, on that point. It's not only the definable, it's probably also the verifiable.
Mm-hmm.
The distinction between natural and legal is something that is really an either-or. The commercial, non-commercial is more blurry, and it can lead to a lot of nuances. So in any case, the first one is verifiable, whereas the second one can be verified, but not as clearly as the first one, probably.
Could I ask a question to you, those of you who are much more experienced than me? I do think it is possible to argue that the distinction between commercial and non-commercial is both blurred and multidimensional and dynamic and so on. On the other hand, it might be perhaps some purpose or some interest for some organization to qualify itself as commercial, upfront saying, "This, I am a commercial organization." Does that have any advantages, and would there be any disadvantages in a commercial sort of fronting, no organization fronting as commercial but really not being it? I mean, would that be part of our discussion, or is that something which doesn't really have any use in real life?
Well, this is Chris. If someone were to self or identify themselves as a natural person at the outset, and yet at another level they indicate that they're involved in commercial operations, even if it's
indeed
a self-declaration, that may carry a consequence.
It certainly would, or it could at least. And as I mentioned, for those jurisdictions which are small, or which there are many, there is perhaps not so such an obvious difference between a company and the person operating that company.
Philip, I suspect the difference may come, of course, is when we move to the next stage of discussion and deciding, okay, what you're going to do with that information.
Yes.
And if the distinction is going to lead to a change in either the amount of data available openly or differences in access to the data, then the distinctions may start to come into play, because if you're looking at legal entities which are non-commercial, I think we'll find some voices who will be looking for no differences in the protection of their data to that of an individual, depending on the nature of that non-commercial organization. And there we start to fall into more challenging ground.
Yeah, I do agree. But if you take the first, we have no two examples. One example is a natural person who is undisputable a natural person, but who says that I am against the commercial activity, and therefore my data is to be treated according to the rules of those engaged in commercial activity. That would have no problem, create no problems in data protection, because it would be the choice of the individual in question. So if you want to include such a provision, that would seem to me not to have much problems related to it. The second issue then, it would be an organization who wants to be treated according to the more restrictive rules guarding data on individuals. And I find that the general distinction between commercial and non-commercial is insufficient to lean upon. But perhaps there is a subset. Is there a more narrowed definition which we could use? For instance, relying upon the an obvious but insufficient example would be the non-government organization accredited to WIPO or something like that.
Exactly. Well, from the practical side, how would a, if you like, a two-tier test of self-declaration work, do you think?
A two-tier test?
Well, as John was describing, that you might, first of all, self-declare I'm either an individual or a legal person, and then you would declare use, say, for purposes of discussion, commercial and non-commercial, and that might have different outcomes in terms of the subsequent access to data.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I don't know. What I was thinking of, which is why your question caught me off guard, was I was trying to categorize myself and my use of my domain name as commercial or non-commercial. So I was thinking through some of the things that I use my domain name for, which includes everything from the weblog that I publish, which is a mixture of kind of policy observation, some of it's commercial, some of it non-commercially motivated. I publish my photographs at my website, those sorts of things. But then when we get into other uses of the domain, like email, for instance, I have personal email running on my domain. I also have a large amount of business mail routed through my domain name. So I would have a hard time. I also solicit charitable donations through email and through my website, et cetera. So I'm not sure where that would fit in. And so just thinking it from a user experience perspective, I would be hard-pressed to say that that making that distinction would be straightforward for your average natural person or an individual user, but it would likely be very straightforward for a legal user. A corporation is, by definition, a commercial interest. Its use of that domain name will be commercial no matter what it's doing. One may want to make an argument that some nonprofit usage might be non-commercial, but I would tend to say that would be more of a boundary case than anything else. In thinking it through from the edge of the network to the center, I really don't know how such a distinction could be made from a practical perspective, and I could think of how it could be made, but I'm just trying to consider what the practical value of that would be.
So there's a very, very valuable contribution in what you're saying, or reminding us on, and that is that the net itself is changing the nature of what is public and private, and that this blurred situation or this situation in which there is a certain vagueness about it, they become more common, and that you are using your website both for personal and commercial or business-like uses. Mm-hmm. That is quite true.
Just one comment on the commercial, non-commercial. It's true, for instance, that there is a difficulty in qualifying, for instance, a personal blog that uses a lot of Google AdWords, for instance, and if the revenue from those ads become significant, is that considered as a commercial activity or not?
Sure.
Another point in terms of methodology, provided that there's an agreement, and I don't say that there is at the moment, but agreement on the distinction between personal and legal, as well as whether there is an agreement on commercial, non-commercial, in any case, it would probably be interesting to analyze what kind of differences it could make in terms of three different layers. One is the type of data that is collected. The second one is the type of data that is available publicly. And three, the type of data or the conditions in which some data that is not accessible publicly is accessible in a non-public manner through other procedures. I think the three layers are different. The example I was giving for France is that the type of data is different for the legal and the personal. The way it is displayed is somehow different. And for instance, even if you have a legal entity, what people are recommended to do is to give the contact points in generic emails, like contact@company-so-and-so, which allows for more flexibility and protection of the individuals that are concerned. And the third layer is that if, for instance, law enforcement agencies are requesting some kind of data, I suppose it is different, or it could be different, when it is from a legal entity or for an individual, for instance. But I think the three layers are important.
I have noted them down. They certainly may be helpful. And it is helpful, I think, if they try to find different aspects and turn this around so we can perhaps come up with some solution that is not based on a simple distinction, but on the combination two tires or something like that, or a combination between data and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Should we briefly reflect on how to proceed from here? There's been the suggestion that we should try to perhaps not brainstorm is the correct reason, but try to come up with examples in this how to make operational or find operational criteria for distinguishing between individual and legal persons, and between and the commercial use. If you made a post it on the list, I would of course take it up myself to try to organize them in such a way that we could use them for a next call.
John, it's Maria here. Could I suggest that maybe I could start putting together a table that we could fill in as we go along with them, you know, with those two sets of criteria and what maybe a number of factors that we could consider in relation to them. So, you know, perhaps in terms of the, say, distinction between legal and natural persons, things of what the distinction is based on, some of it summarizing your paper, and then how the distinction can be made in terms of perhaps criteria. And we're going back to the wish list idea that I think Neil suggested.
That sounds excellent. Also, I think we should perhaps have some sort of maximum data sheet. You know, what are we talking about exactly? I have pulled the data available from several US databases, but I'm not quite sure whether I have, due to my lack of experience, have a clear understanding of what is the maximum data that we would expect to find available for such a database.
This is Chris. One thing that might be helpful, I looked at that, it was the background note that was published by the staff the other day, and that indicated as an example what is currently possible to look at in the Who Is, a complete Who Is record, and you know, it's right there on the page as an example, and then there was a different example under the OPOC approach. So, I mean, you could look at just the data, everything that's possible by looking at that background, or I think as an example of the whole list of things that could be collected.
Perhaps this is the time also to float another idea. There is in some jurisdictions, there is the notion of trivial data, trivial personal data, which are not to be subject to any restrictions, which is a small set, of course, but it includes important things like name and addresses. Would it be useful to have a sort of a set of these data as trivial, and then have the rest of the data, and then some sensitive data that probably don't occur at all, or only very rarely in the legislation.
Mrs. Avery, can I ask a question? Is that definition of trivial data a global definition of trivial data, or is it sort of an ad hoc local thing?
It's not an ad hoc thing, but it is a local thing.
Okay.
It's a systematic local thing. There is no the notion of trivial data is not universally or globally accepted.
Okay, then I would probably add that it's probably problematic to include it.
Yeah, so it certainly couldn't be included with reference to some sort of consensus, it must be included with us as based on our own policies. So that we thought this was a good idea. And if you don't think it is a good idea, there's no reason to pursue it further.
I think it's an interesting question because it does lead us to think about if we are going to make distinctions based on the nature of registrant, then what does that mean in terms of the data that appears there? So it's although the terminology may be local, I think the concept would have global applicability. I mean, for me, I was just trying to draw a little matrix in which I was looking at the four options that come out of the different combinations between legal and natural and commercial and non-commercial. And assuming you had a registrant who would make a self-declaration, and let's just look at the meaning of that self-declaration first. And there, and suppose you characterize result of those self-declarations as being either open in terms of somehow more open of data or closed in terms of more closed, like we're suggesting perhaps with the OPOC proposal, then to my mind, if you're either legal or natural, but also declaring commercial, then you would fall into the open category. If you are natural person and declaring also non-commercial, then you would fall into the closed category.
Indeed.
And that leaves us with the fourth possibility, which is, to my mind, a grey area, that you're a legal person and declaring non-commercial.
Yeah.
And what does that mean?
Yeah. And that obviously will be a category where you cannot to the same extent as in the other three categories, to base yourself on self-declaration. Somebody has to take there has to be some additional either criteria or procedures to determine who belongs to that category.
Well, you can have self-declaration, but you first determine what you want to do with the declaration, and then I think to might necessarily say the second point, it always becomes if there is then verification of that or a challenge mechanism in terms of the accuracy.
Indeed.
But that's second stage, yeah.
But that is matrix I think was quite helpful, quite helpful suggestion. And if you then also looked at the table that Maria suggested.
It's Maria again. Actually, matrix is the word that I was looking for. But I would try and follow along what Philip has suggested, and maybe develop some more of the criteria within that structure.
Yeah, there may be superior criteria or alternative criteria as well.
Mm. Yeah, this is about how I think the. There might be a difficulty here in using too often the open and closed metaphor as if it were only one either or regime.
Mm.
For instance, the modalities to access a given set of data bring a completely different type of protection of privacy. Like, for instance, I can be willing to see whether a given domain name is owned by somebody that I suspect has requested this, has registered this domain name because this person has already registered a lot of others that are infringing upon my rights, for instance. You could very well have a way to address the database that allows you to search everything, and you can ask the name of who registered this domain name, or have something that allows you to say, is Mr. So-and-so the registrant for this domain name? These are two different modalities of access that give answer to the same question, but in one case, the database can be mined in a completely open manner, and in the other one, it's a per-request question. So I think we should keep in mind in the whole discussion that not only the type of data that is collected, but the technical modalities for access are very, very different, and that there are many possibilities beyond the simple public or non-public. Yep. Even what is public can be accessed in many different ways.
That is a primary reminder, and perhaps we also should add that we have occasionally pressed upon the role of law enforcement agencies. I'm not too keen on pursuing that very far, but there are, of course, also other organizations that one might grant access beyond what an occasional or user would require, organizations that had a strong interest in maintaining certain or pursuing certain objectives. For instance, rights holder organizations, which certainly would be a controversial example, but illustrates my point.
Which organization? I'm not sure I understood the last what kind of organization?
No, sorry. I write all these organizations, like the organizations for the movie industry, for instance. This is a controversial example, but you might have different rules for a private investigator and a trade organization seeking the same information. It's not necessarily a good idea, so do not let yourself be distracted by it.
This is Chris. These are all, you know, useful and interesting points. My concern is that if you go with anything that starts to be too finely tuned on an international basis, I think the perfect will be the enemy of the good. And that you have to stay with basic distinctions. My concern is that as this system has evolved over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, who is in its role as recognized by the GAC has also evolved and has become a fundamental element. And what creating even the basic distinction of natural person versus legal person could, for example, create huge incentives for those who think they might benefit by declaring themselves as natural persons at the time of registration, because if they think that that will provide a more evasive way for them to conduct, you know, fraudulent or other harmful activities, and they see this set of rules, and they'd say, okay, I'm just now going to self-declare as a natural person because I immediately see it's going to make life more difficult for all those who would want to try to pursue me and stop my spam, my fraudulent phishing, and anything else. So, you know, I even though we can talk about all of the finely tuned approaches on an international basis, scaling that's going to be very difficult. So we have to think. I think that the basic matrix that has started to be discussed is the one that we should focus on as possibly workable. But even then, as I say, there are huge concerns as to the incentives it would create for those that might want to perpetrate malicious activity.
Yes, thank you. Yes, that I think was a point well taken, and thank you for that. I take it then that we try to have one more go at the emerging matrix and see what we can do with that. With the help of all of you, your suggestions and Maria's kind assistance, I'm sure we'll have something better to discuss next time.
Sounds good.
Yes?
This is just a question of process. Will the same call-in numbers be used for each teleconference?
Normally, yes.
Right. That's a clear, though, conditioned answer, yes.
And also,
Glenn will give us ample advance notice if there is a change, right?
I know there was also some concern for those on the West Coast, for example, of the United States, who found the time was pretty darn early in the morning, but I'm not sure that there's anything that can be done about that, given the stack nature of the calls.
We are, of course, trying to factor in time zones right across the world, from Asia through to Australia, etc. So alas, there's always going to be somebody who suffers.
Yeah. Yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, are there any more issues we would like to table?
Hi, this is Bertrand. It's not really an issue. I found the exchange interesting, and especially the not trying to fine-tune the regime too much as a valid argument. One thing I wanted to raise is maybe a way to formulate the question. As I understand, and once again, I'm coming rather late in the process, and so apologies for the questions that are sometimes a bit naive. But as far as I understand, the OPOC proposal is putting the cursor of the privacy protection in a completely opposite direction somehow than what the previous WHOIS regime was. In a nutshell, in the previous and existing ways, a lot is visible and a lot is accessible, and in the OPOC proposal, relatively little is really visible, and there are conditions for access through the operating point of contact and potentially other actors. So the question that we're facing, if I understand well after this discussion, is somehow boiled down to one question. Given the protection that is now given in the context of the OPOC proposal, is there a need for additional protection for individuals?
Yes, that is.
Is that a right way to put the question?
Yeah, that certainly is a question that has to be answered.
I think it's one question, Bertrand, but it also opens up the possibility of either sort of rolling back some of the either open publication or different means of access to the data. So you have those two streams that might apply in certain circumstances. If we feel that the privacy concerns are going to be as well accommodated by a change there as they would be with the raw OPOC proposals we have it today.
I missed half of what you were saying, Philip, because I was unmuting my line. I'm sorry if you said this already, but I think, Bertrand, another way of asking that same question is, does the OPOC proposal go too far in affording broad anonymity to commercial enterprises? And is that something that we need to adjust through this process? I think, certainly
yes.
In my conversations in Lisbon, everybody was very, very edgy about the broadness of the privacy protections in the OPOC proposal, and I think it was clear that they need to be dialed back a bit. So I'm not so sure that that focusing on the needs of the individual, I think we've gone far enough there, but perhaps too far in other areas.
Well, actually, thanks for the comment. This is exactly the point I was making. The feeling I had in Lisbon is that somehow the OPOC proposal has gone in a certain direction in the protection of privacy, and I was feeling that some actors were wondering whether the balance was not somewhere in the middle and where the distinction might be operational. And this is why I was trying to reframe for my own the discussion.
But Philip, I think that's right, and that's why we're having this discussion and trying to my mind, in this work group, see what it is that's required to make the OPOC proposal universally thought of as change for the better.
Yeah, and certainly your matrix is one way of a step in that direction. Because it always, it is not focused on only one thing, but has at least two foci. Yes. Any other business? We're approaching, my watch, I should say, is approaching 3 o'clock. I think then I'll thank you very much for easing me so easily into a role for chairing this meeting. This has been a new experience for me. I hope to repeat it next week. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, we can stay online if we're going into the next one. Is that the case?
Only if you promise to be good, Aubrey.
But there's a half hour.
Only if you promise to be good.
I was good this time, wasn't I?
there was a half hour gap there, I think.
Yeah, there's a half hour gap.
Okay, then I definitely won't stay on.
Yes, because I left overlap time.
Oh, I hadn't quite realized that. Okay, then I'll hang up and call back. Okay.
Bye.
Thank you.
Maria?
John is here, but...
Hi, John. Okay. No, I was just asking Maria if she would tell me who was on the call. Because you saw it was yourself, Philip, Jacquand.
Oh, yes, did I forget to take a roll call?
No. It's fine. I'll do it. Was Lynn Goodenough on the call?
Lynn Goodenough was on the call, yes.
Yes.
We had Chris somebody.
And Chris, you had Chris
Christopher
Gibson.
Uh-huh.
And Rudy Van Snick?
It doesn't say so here.
Oh.
Let me take Philip, of course, Ross. Bertrand de la Trapelle, Maria is Christopher Gibson, then it's Michel, Avery, Neil Schwartzman, and then
Neil Schwartzman, and who is the last one?
Lynn
Goodenough. Okay, thanks ever so much. Okay, that's fine. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay, is there anything else you want me to do, Glenn?
No, that's fine. Thanks, John. Nothing at all. Just next week, same time.
Goodbye.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.